afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you are in the world, and welcome to another episode of Information Week Live. This is Information Week Live for the week of January 18th, 2015. I'm Kurt Franklin, your host for Information Week Live this week, and we are excited to have you here because we've got a great show lined up. We're going to be talking about security, Windows 10, Oracle, all kinds of stuff, but before we do, we want to remind everyone that we are part of a community. InformationWeek.com also includes the world of security, darkreading.com, everything about networks, networkcomputing.com, and of course, the event that is connecting the IT community, Interop Las Vegas, coming to you April 27th through May 1st, 2015, from the exciting and glamorous Mandalay Bay Convention Center in beautiful Las Vegas, Nevada. For more information, go to www.interop.com. Well, we're going to get things started this week by scaring the dickens out of you, because that's usually what happens when we talk about cybersecurity. And to do that, we have our favorite security journalist with us, Sarah Peters, and senior editor at Dark Reading. Sarah, welcome to Information Week Live.
Thank you, Kurt. Happy to be here as usual.
So I suppose you're going to tell us that this has been the most boring week on record in security, that there is absolutely nothing going on. Am I close?
Well, you know, as security goes, it's been a quieter week than we've had in a while, partly because nothing new from Sony has really come out. But I would say that the biggest news, in my opinion, this week was in relation to the proposed changes to cybersecurity legislation that President Obama came out with earlier this week.
Now, with this new proposal from the White House, is this actually anything new, or is it more a formal statement of ideas that have been out there for a while?
Well, that's a little bit hard to say. I mean, with everything, it's always tweaks to existing law as opposed to new laws entirely. But what the trouble is that it's very evident that these things came from people who do not understand the job of security professionals. Because what has always been a problem with the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and other, all other kinds of criminal law, is that there's not anything that really counts criminal intent into the letter of the law. And with some things, that's understandable. Like, you know, if you kill somebody, usually criminal intent of some kind is implied. But with computer science, it's a lot less clear cut. So, for example, one thing that's always been a trouble is the disparity between how software vulnerability research is legislated. That disparity between that and how website vulnerability disclosure is handled. As we know, you can take your Microsoft Windows and beat the crap out of it and discover all kinds of new horrible ways to exploit it. And then you can create exploit code for it, and you can put it up for the entire universe to see. The entire universe, obviously, including criminals who are going to exploit it for nasty purposes. And that's totally legal. But if you want to simply have a look at, say, eBay or Amazon or any website and just peek to see, is this secure or not, merely looking is a felony under the law as it stands. It's not always enforced, but technically that is a criminal thing. It's not something that happens in civil court. It's felony. So the newest changes that have been made don't solve that problem at all. And in fact, it's now that certain things are being redefined, it could make life for all security researchers more difficult because it doesn't clarify, are you using these tools, are you conducting these activities to aid security, or are you doing these things with the intention of committing other kinds of crimes? And that's, like I said, that these proposed changes are probably just going to exacerbate that problem as opposed to solve it.
Well, now, is it fair to say that these seem to have been written from the point of view of the large corporations? In any set of federal regulations, it's assumed that there are winners and losers. You've talked about who loses with all of this. Who are the real winners in this new proposed legislation?
I don't think anybody's really actually a winner. I think what they believe is going to happen is that this is going to help law enforcement catch the bad guys. But so for law enforcement, it could be helpful because it gives them a little bit more authority to reach out and touch anybody they think might know something about anything. So let me just give you an example. With now hacking has been added to the description of racketeering. Okay, so what does that mean? If you are considered part of a hacking group, if you're just kind of hanging out in a chat room where you expect there might be some criminal hackers there, but there's also plenty of just regular old good guy white hat security people, if you're just participating in a conversation on a chat room, does that mean that you are associating with known felons or possible felons? And if that's the case, if they can use the law to make that argument, then they can go to your house and they can collect all of your computing devices and take them back and look all through them. Even if they're not going to accuse you and charge you with a crime, they could still use that part of the law potentially to confiscate all of your possessions. So that's one of those things that we don't know how it's going to be interpreted, but that's where some of the people in the security community are worried.
Well, we know that this is a proposal. Are the folks in the security community confident, or perhaps afraid might be a better word, that this is going to be passed into law in more or less an intact state, or do we anticipate lots of lobbying on both sides? From the political point of view, where does all this stand?
With that, I think honestly most people don't worry that things are going to get passed in Congress anymore because so little actually gets passed anymore. But there are some efforts being made by the security industry to reach out to the politicians and say, let's talk this over and get this law right. Because obviously the security professionals want to stop the bad guys too. Nobody's against that idea. It's simply the way that the laws are written or the ways that the laws are interpreted. That's where everything gets fussy. It's not that anybody's against stopping crime. It's just they don't seem to understand the difference between criminal use of technology and completely normal use of technology. It's kind of like driving a car is completely legal. But if you're the getaway driver for a giant bank heist, you're still going to get in trouble, even if all you were doing was driving a car, because if you know that you were helping commit and carry out a crime, you're still going to get dinged for it. You're not just going to get like a speeding ticket for driving too fast away from the bank that you just stole money from. We need to incorporate that kind of thing into cybercrime law, because there's obviously a big difference between using what you might consider surveillance equipment to make sure that you're looking at inbound and outbound traffic inside your network. Or there's a million a million different ways that you can interpret what these tools are and how you use them. In fact, lots of things that are already usually used in big corporations, security departments, could be considered criminal going forward if this law is passed the way it is. They want to help keep surveillance equipment, and they want to be able to prevent people from stealing databases and social security numbers and selling them overseas. It's and obviously we're all behind that half of it, but the way that things are going, it's not making a clear distinction between what the regular security pro is doing to protect their enterprise and what the bad guy is doing to steal from that enterprise. It's basically criminalizing both at the same time. Does that make
sense? It sounds like this is the sort of thing that could be the gift that keeps on giving for those of us in journalism around this. So I have a feeling this is not going to be the last time we talk about this particular issue.
No, I mean, this has been a problem for ages, and it's not going to go away. We'll be able to talk about it for years, I'm sure.
Oh, boy. I like that idea. Well,
yay.
Sort of on a related note, when you're talking about legislation that would discourage people from becoming vulnerability researchers, I know you had an article this week that looked at the importance of a diverse community of vulnerability researchers. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? Why is it important to have different sorts of people looking for computer vulnerabilities?
Yeah, so that was related to some research that came out this week from some people at Penn State. They were interested kind of in how the white hat vulnerability disclosure market works. And for their purposes, they took a look at all the activity happening on a web vulnerability disclosure platform called Wuyun that operates in China. Now, in China, they don't have the laws that we have here that I described earlier that prohibits people from looking for vulnerabilities in websites. Okay, that's why this platform exists, where anybody can look for a vulnerability in any website and report it to Wuyun. While here, we would have to have explicit vulnerability disclosure programs and bug bounties created by the site owners themselves. Like Microsoft has one of those. But in China, you don't have that same same kind of set of legal complications and limitations, right? So they looked at what was happening in Wuyun because it gave a much broader perspective on what kinds of vulnerabilities are discovered and how they're reported and just the whole operations of the white hat community out there. And what they discovered was that as the population of white hat hackers grew, and as it expanded into new territories, whether or not it was just because of more competition between hackers, they started looking for vulnerabilities in a larger number of websites and started looking for a wider variety of vulnerabilities, and also looking for vulnerabilities that were more high severity as opposed to just ones that were kind of easy to find. So now things like SQL injection and cross-site scripting, those have always been a big deal. Everybody still gets them wrong, and it's pretty easy to track down those kinds of vulnerabilities. But what they've found is that the lesser-known things, the things like just configuration errors or privilege escalation and access control bypasses, the things that were less commonly found before are now being found more frequently as the kind of white hat workforce expands. So, and you know, because there are people who are familiar with different websites, if they're in a different country, they're now looking at sites that were overlooked years before. So more people and more bigger and more diverse workforce is definitely a good thing if you're in the white hat hacker community. And like you said, the more laws we put up that make that job very dangerous, the less likely we are going to be able to increase the community of white hat hackers.
Well, it sounds like that's another thing where diversity is good, and it's always nice to have you bringing us news like that about the security world. Now, tell us very quickly, Sarah, what kind of things do you have preparing for next week, and where can people follow you to keep up with all of your reporting on the world of cybersecurity?
Well, you can always find me on Twitter at Sarah Peters. That's S-A-R-A-P-E-T-E-R-S, no H. It's hard to say exactly what's going to happen next week because there will probably be some new breach, and there will probably be some new person angry about some kind of privacy violation. Those are the things we can imagine that are going to happen somewhere. So you can basically count on that happening at Dark Reading next week. And also we're just going to be doing some new research into insider threats, some ways to make sure that you're complying with the new PCI regulations, and also some advancements in payment technology, what goes beyond just the card in your wallet. And that's what we've got going on for now, and maybe we'll fill you in on what's happened next week.
Outstanding. Well, Sarah, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Kurt.
That was Sarah Peters, senior editor at Dark Reading, a sister site of InformationWeek.com. If you are at all interested in things concerning cybersecurity and ITSec, you owe it to yourself to make Dark Reading a part of your regular weekly reading routine. In addition, there is Dark Reading Radio. I had a great episode last week. Dark Reading Radio is available on demand under the radio tab at darkreading.com. Well, in addition to all of the security stuff going on in the world, a little company in Redmond, Washington had some announcements this week. And our own Kelly Sheridan has been writing about Windows 10 and the announcements around it. Kelly, welcome to Information Week Live.
Hi, Kurt. Thanks for having me.
So, first of all, why don't you give us just a quick rundown about why Windows 10 is or is not the greatest thing to happen in personal computing in the last 10 years?
Well, how much time do we have here? in all seriousness, Microsoft really surprised us, surprised me this week, in addition to a few members of the tech community, with its announcements around Windows 10 for mobile, Windows 10 for desktop. It came out with a new enterprise-targeted device called the Microsoft Surface Hub, and then it surprised us with something called Windows Holographic, which is kind of like a virtual reality invention. You wear some headgear, and it projects images into midair or on other objects, and you can touch things and move it around. It's pretty cool.
Well, I know that we're going to have Dave Wagner on a bit later, and he was talking about, the Geekend this week, he wrote about HoloLens. So I think we'll let him jump all over that one. But I'd love to hear more about the Windows 10 sort of desktop and mobile. How close are they? Is Microsoft really trying to make one experience, or are they going off in different directions with these two products?
Well, it looks like uniting the customer experience across devices is becoming a primary focus at Microsoft. Among their announcements was the debut of a feature called Continuum and of universal apps. So there are plenty of apps, including Office 365, it's kind of like a revamped touch-focused version of Office that'll be available on smartphones, tablets, and PCs, and they're really focused on delivering a consistent experience across all devices. So your apps will look the same across all devices, your documents will be centrally stored, your settings will be centrally stored. So if you're working on a PC and you need to transition over to a tablet, everything will kind of stay the same. You'll still have access to everything you were working on.
Well, I know that I'm sorry, go right ahead.
Oh, no, continue.
Well, I was going to say we've heard a lot since Satya Nadella became CEO of Microsoft about the cloud direction. Did they do anything in Windows 10, either on the mobile side or the desktop side, maybe for both, that really continues a push in the direction of the cloud? Are there specific cloud-centric things going on in this new version of the operating system?
You know, they didn't mention much about cloud specifically. This was more of a consumer preview, so a lot of it was targeted to consumers. But that definitely seems like the direction that they're continuing to go. I know that's a primary focus of Microsoft going forward, and it seems like a central component to their announcements this week.
Okay. Now, you talked as well about the hub. Before we get there, I do have to ask, though, from what you saw, I know that the whole Windows 8 interface, Metro or Era, whatever they're calling it these days, that interface has been a real lightning rod for both praise and criticism. Are they doubling down on this particular interface? Did they show that they're making tweaks to it? Or did they really just not talk about the interface very much in all their announcements?
Well, it seems like they're trying to address where they went wrong with Windows 8. I know that's become a central focus at Microsoft. And part of how they're doing that is consulting the feedback of their Windows insiders. So each build that's developed of Windows 10 goes to, I think it was 1.7 million people tested the latest build, and they provided thousands and thousands of pieces of feedback to Microsoft. So a lot of what they're doing is based on what they're hearing from their users. I know that some of what they're doing is designed to make people who liked Windows 8 happy, but also make people who liked Windows 7 happy. For example, something as simple as the start menu. I know the start menu in the desktop can be viewed in the traditional like little form on the bottom of the screen, or people can choose to make it full size. You know, it's really, it's more customizable, the new experience.
All right. Well, to turn away from that user interface, you mentioned this idea of the hub as being sort of an enterprise-centric management thing. Tell me a little bit about that hub.
Sure. Well, the Microsoft Surface Hub is an 84-inch display. It's designed to facilitate collaboration and brainstorming in meetings. So the device is created with built-in sensors and cameras so that, for example, let's say someone needs to host a meeting and they'll enter their information in ahead of time. So the device, when you walk into the room, the device knows that it's you holding the meeting, and remote participants can be accessed. So someone holding a meeting via this smart board device can talk to people in different parts of the world, different parts of the country, and they can write on the screen with a stylus, and the people who are remote viewers can still see all that information. So when they were demoing this product, the person who was using it just picked up the stylus and the whiteboard launched and went straight into the meeting. And it's all about bringing more rich data into brainstorming and really taking the ideas from everyone involved in a meeting and putting that on the screen.
One of the things we heard about out at CES, I heard company after company say that they wanted to make it so that the user of a product or the user of a technology didn't have to think about that technology. It really sounds like that's the direction that Microsoft is taking with this Surface Hub. They're trying to make it just a tool that is used naturally rather than something that you really have to spend a lot of time learning about and adapting your way of working to the technology. Am I missing something, or does that strike you as being that way as well?
Oh, absolutely. It's almost like what they said. Let's take this simple concept of walking into a room and doing regular work on a whiteboard. Now let's apply technology to that and make the experience 10 times better. It's just like a form of collaborative whiteboarding, if you will, really connecting people through technology into one device.
Now, with all of this, is there going to be one grand day when the world changes? Did Microsoft talk about when all of this is going to be available? And if so, is it going to be one big thing, or is it going to roll out over time?
Well, sort of a combination of both. Microsoft is revealing pieces of details about the new OS as it rolls out. This past Wednesday was the first such event where it unveiled a whole bunch of features that people can expect to see in Windows 10 desktop and Windows 10 mobile. And they'll be they just released the technical preview for the Windows 10 desktop today. It just became available to insiders. So now people can sign up to become an insider, or people who are already insiders can access the new OS and try the different features. Granted, the build that they just released doesn't have quite as many features as the desktop preview that they showed at the event on Wednesday, but you can still try the new Cortana, you can try the Xbox app, you can try the new settings, the wireless audio and video connections. There's still a lot that you can try. And they are going to release the mobile debut to insiders, I believe, in February. So within the coming weeks, insiders will be able to try the new mobile version of Windows 10 on their smartphones and provide feedback to Microsoft so they can make it better.
That's really interesting. As everyone who's been around software knows, the tech preview is indeed a very, very early version, but it's nice that they are going to be releasing it a little bit more widely and soliciting that feedback from a wider community. It gets back to what Sarah Peters was talking about in her segment. People seem to be recognizing that diversity is good in all sorts of directions.
Oh, absolutely.
Now, I have to ask, you've been talking about a bunch of different things. With everything that you heard about, everything that you saw, what excited you the most? What struck you as being the most meaningful piece of all the products on display in this set of announcements?
Oh, well, obviously the holographic thing was really cool, also because I wasn't expecting to see something like that. But I'm also really interested to see what more comes of the Windows Phone. As that rolls out, I currently don't use a Windows Phone, but I'd really be interested in learning more about the different capabilities that that's going to have and how that'll help Windows compete with Apple and with Android in the future, because right now the Windows Phone kind of lags behind those two, but I'm really interested in seeing what Microsoft is going to try to do to bring that ahead.
Very good. And do you anticipate more stories coming up in the coming weeks, or do you think that we're going to have a delay on more news while the company waits for feedback? What are your plans in terms of covering the continued evolution of Windows 10?
Microsoft comes out with new stuff pretty much every single day. Just today they announced that they bought a company called Revolution Analytics. You would think that there would be kind of a lag given everything that they've released this week, but the truth is you never really know what to expect. You know, it's like they do something new every day. So while I can't predict that, what's going to happen next week, I can say that I'm looking forward to hearing feedback on the latest build of the Windows desktop, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what people have to say about that.
Outstanding. And now, where can people follow you and learn about what you are covering here at Information Week? I assume that you are on Twitter, Instagram, Carrier Pigeon, all kinds of things. How do people keep up with what you're doing?
Well, my carrier pigeon is broken, but you can always find me on Twitter. My handle is Kelly Sheridan. That's KellySheridan22. So you can always find me there. I'm always tweeting my stories from Information Week and all the editors' stories. So, yeah, that's a good way to find me.
Well, Kelly, thanks for taking time out of your busy day, keeping up with Microsoft, to be with us here on Information Week Live.
Sure thing. Thank you for having me.
That was Kelly Sheridan, an associate editor here at Information Week, talking about Microsoft and Windows 10, their announcements this week. We've got more on those announcements coming up a bit later in the show. Before we continue, though, want to remind everyone that this is Information Week Live. You can always find previous episodes of Information Week Live available on demand in the radio section of Information Week. We're also available on demand at blogtalkradio.com and soon in iTunes. So we will let everyone know when that happens. Well, we're going to pivot now from Microsoft to the world of Oracle. Oracle, another huge player in the enterprise software world and beyond, as I think we're about to hear. To talk to us about that, we have Doug Henschen, an executive editor here at Information Week. Doug, welcome to Information Week Live.
Hi, Kurt. How are you?
I am enjoying being in the studio since it is raining cats and dogs here in North Florida. I hope that you are someplace warm and dry.
Snow soon in New Jersey. I'm going to make a liar out of you and talk a little bit about Microsoft before we switch to Oracle. Kelly mentioned the pending acquisition of Revolution Analytics. I just filed a story about it. That's big news for me and the whole data analysis world because Microsoft really hasn't had a product like a workbench, a data mining workbench, a statistical analysis product for data scientists and statisticians. That's really been an area that, SAS is the market share leader. IBM acquired SPSS in 2009 to gain a deeper presence in analytics. Analytics is huge in this whole drive towards big data analysis, data-driven decisions. Businesses want to get to beyond business intelligence, the rearview mirror, and toward predictive analysis, what's coming. So that's an important move. Revolution was founded in 2007. It focuses on the open source R language, and R has been coming on strong. Companies like SAS and the commercial vendors that have prevailed will kind of say, well, they're a mile wide and an inch deep because, there's lots of academicians and students that are contributing R code. And it doesn't get maintained. They put it forward as a master's thesis or something, and so it's out there. And people point to the sheer volume of R programs and algorithms out there. But I think we've seen a huge embrace of R in commercial software. SAP, Oracle, Microsoft has been using it in areas like gaming and Bing, and this year in 2014 they introduced something called Azure ML, Azure Machine Learning, a service on Azure that uses R-based machine learning algorithms. So I think R is just getting stronger and stronger, and this is a pretty important announcement.
Well, I have to agree. It's an important announcement because it fills a hole in Microsoft's product offerings. I know that you've been watching this space very closely for a long time. You cover it in great depth. So from your perspective, how big a surprise was this acquisition? Was it known that Microsoft was looking to make an acquisition in this space, or did this really sort of come out of nowhere and catch people by surprise?
I was surprised. I don't cover advanced analytics every day, but I know the space pretty well. And, this I know that they've been using R internally. They've been, as I said, the Azure Machine Learning launch this summer is based on R. The R community is important, and they did lack a tool sort of for the data scientists and statisticians, data miners. It's a growing area, so an important move. They haven't even closed the deal yet, so they're not really saying a lot. It seems like a sure thing that, it's a letter of intent and everything is signed, so it's only a matter of weeks, I would assume, and they'll say they're going to provide more details on the product fit down the road. It's not really kind of like an office-type product. They've had some analytics within Microsoft SQL Server. They've had a smattering of analytics within their Hadoop offering. So it'll be interesting to see how they offer this as a product. It's not really like something that you would, tack on to Excel. It's definitely a sort of a power user type of product. So we'll see how that plays.
Well, it sounds like this is not the last story you're going to be writing on this. We'll look forward to this breaking news coming out. Glad that you covered that. And I honestly didn't. It was sufficiently breaking that I didn't know if you were going to be ready to even mention it. That's why I didn't put it in the intro.
Yeah.
But I'm glad that you brought it up. You look at a lot of different things in this whole enterprise business intelligence space. And I guess that's one of the reasons why your story this week about the Oracle server surprised me a little bit. I know that Oracle has been in this server business for a while, but I have to admit I don't think of them as being one of the major players in that hardware space. And it sounds like they're really trying to become a much more significant player there. Is that the sort of the foundation behind the story this week?
Well, they got in when they acquired Sun, SunSpark servers. So that was their entry into the hardware business. And Sun was also doing stuff with x86 Intel-based machines. So that's where it all began, and that was 2009. But right before that, about a year or two before that, they had a partnership with HP, and they were doing what are called engineered systems. And their first was Exadata. And the story here is software and hardware, pre-integrated to work better together. And so they started that even before they acquired Sun, and the partner was HP. HP's CEO at the time, Mark Hurd. A lot happened there. Mark went over to Oracle. Soon enough, they were acquiring Sun and starting up their own hardware business. This week, I've heard this number before this week, but they're saying now that they've shipped 10,000 of these engineered systems of one sort or another, most going by the Exa lingo, Exa data, Exa logic, Exalytics. They have others that are, big data appliance. Those are all x86 products. They also have the supercluster, which is engineered system built on the Sun Spark server technology. This week, they announced a new front with the Oracle Virtual Compute Appliance. And with this, they're going after sort of the converged data center infrastructure market. And that's where Cisco has been growing very aggressively, even faster than Oracle, with the Oracle UCS line of servers. And it's basically, you have your server, but it's pre-installed with the operating system and virtualization. In their case, it's Red Hat Linux, and it's VMware with their partner VMware and EMC. EMC also provides the storage. So Oracle's going after them. They're saying that their Oracle Virtual Compute appliance is going to be half the cost of the UCS, the comparable UCS product. So they're going after this, you know, core data center building block general purpose two socket server, and you know, that's with this product. There's a little less Oracle hardware. It's the Oracle Linux and Oracle's virtualization software, but it still fits in that sort of engineered system strategy.
Well, it sounds like there's going to be a great deal more to cover and to talk about in what I know many people had thought was a market segment that we should give up for dead a few years ago, but it sounds like there's plenty of life left in the segment after all. Well, Doug, can you tell us real quickly what you have on tap and how people can follow you and keep up with all your stories here at Information Week?
Well, I'm Dee Henschen at on Twitter, at Dee Henschen, D-H-E-N-S-C-H-E-N. My stuff is on InformationWeek.com every day. And I put stuff on LinkedIn here and there, so you can follow me there. I think next week we're going to have a little bit more news from Microsoft on their cloud BI products, and I've been briefed on some news from the Oracle Service Cloud for next week. So those are two topics that will come up.
Well, we will look forward to all of that. Doug, thanks so much for being with us here today on Information Week Live.
All right. Have a great weekend, folks.
That was Doug Henschen, an executive editor here at Information Week, talking about both Microsoft and Oracle with big news in the enterprise space for this week. Well, we're going to move from covering news to talking about communities. And we want to talk next about the community around Interop. And to do that, we have the man who's in charge of communities at Interop, Andrew Conry Murray. Drew, welcome to Information Week Live.
Hi, Kirk. Great to be here.
So I know that we are in the countdown to Interop. It's going to be coming up in, four short months. So can you share with us some of what's going on in the preparation? What do you see that's starting to get you excited about the community at Interop this year?
Well, we've got a lot of stuff going on for Las Vegas. In addition to Interop, which is 2 days of workshops and then 3 days of sessions plus keynotes and the show floor, we also have the Cloud Connect Summit, which is 3 days of cloud-specific sessions and discussions going on. We've got the Information Week Conference, which is aimed at CIOs and IT executives. Information Week Conference is co-hosted at Interop. They're bringing in lots of great names to talk at a higher level about IT strategy and IT's relationship with the business. And we've got something new that we're doing this year with Dark Reading, which is one of the publications, a sister publication in the Information Week family. Dark Reading's doing a special day focused on information security. They just got the site up. It's a cybersecurity crash course. And it's an opportunity for cybersecurity experts to interface with executives and cybersecurity professionals to talk about what are the most key elements, key areas that you should be worried about in security. You're going to be talking about the latest breaches, vulnerabilities, emerging threats. It's an opportunity for folks to connect with experts and also their peers in a collegial environment to sort of level check with each other and find out what are you guys doing, how are you handling this issue, what's going on, what are you seeing on the security frontier. So that's exciting, a strong focus on security for Interop this year.
It does sound like a lot of very good stuff going on. And I have to admit, I know, I think, a couple of people who are going to be speaking in those various portions of the conference. We're also working, I know, to bring the community together ahead of the physical conference through things like Interop Radio. Can you tell us, you know, what some of these things are that are going on around Interop? to help bring the community together? I know we're doing a great deal here at Information Week. What do you see? I know that you write some blog entries to give people focuses. What else is going on around the community prior to the show?
Yeah, so one of the things that we hear when we query people about Interop and what they get out of it is that peer-to-peer, face-to-face interaction that folks have, where you either know people when you get there or you meet people for the first time, and you know, you share information, you exchange ideas. That personal contact is really essential and important to folks. That's one of the biggest values they get, aside from all the great content that we put together. So we're looking at ways to take that community that kind of forms in the live space, face-to-face, and find a way to expand and enhance it throughout the year so that we can give folks an opportunity to still interact with each other, get together with each other, share ideas with each other. So, of course, I've got blogs that I'm posting on Interop's portal on informationweek.com. And you and I have been working together on Interop Radio, which is a weekly podcast for the community where we're bringing in great speakers to talk about all kinds of amazing stuff. So you've done a couple of shows on SDN. You had Howard Marks, a storage expert, to come on and talk about what's new in storage. You've been talking about IT leadership and IT management, so it's not just technology. That's another way for the community to get involved, whether they want to just listen in or download a podcast later, or you know, join in the live chat during the podcast. So these are the kinds of things we're trying to do to create those opportunities to interact and work together throughout the year, and so that either it enhances or augments what you get in a live setting when you're face-to-face with folks.
Yeah, it seems to me that one of the themes behind all of that is that we're offering a lot of different ways for people to be involved in the community. Once upon a time, the theory was that you tried to get everyone to do one thing, and it seems like Interop is recognizing that it's a diverse community with a diverse set of needs for how they are becoming part of that community. So I'm seeing stuff on social media. You mentioned the blog post, the radio. There are just all kinds of ways for people to get information and become engaged as part of the community. And it seems to me in the conversations we've had that the engagement is a really big part of what you're trying to do there.
Absolutely, and it's not just me blogging. We also invite, you know, if you're an IT expert and you have something to share, you know, get in touch with me, let me know. We'd be happy to get you on the site. There are numerous blogs on the site where you'll see conversations going on with folks, you know, commenting and recommenting and sharing information with each other underneath the main story. So that's also a great way to get involved instead of just, you know, it's not just about us transmitting out to you. It's about the community also feeding back their insights and opinions to us as well. And we really value that. So we are trying to find as many ways as we can to enhance that. Social media is certainly another big way. I've got a profile, you've got a profile, Interop has a profile on Twitter and Facebook, so you can follow us, comment, share stuff, all kinds of opportunities to connect. But yeah, the general goal is to build that community instead of just having this sort of one-time-a-year thing that then everybody disperses. It's a way to maintain those connections and make new connections throughout the year.
There are lots of things. Now tell us real quickly, Drew, what's coming up in the let's say, next couple of weeks? Anything new, anything exciting, anything we should keep our eyes open for in the world of Interop?
Well, definitely keep your ears peeled for the weekly Interop radio show. As I said, some great guests are coming on to talk about both technology and leadership. Sometimes we forget about the human element of trying to run an IT department or contribute to a business. So the interviews and stuff that you're doing there, you know, going to shine a light on, you know, managing folks is often just as important or even more important than sitting in front of a screen running commands. So that's definitely one thing to look out for. If we're open for registration now, if you want to go see some of the great speakers that we're bringing in, keynote speakers, workshop leaders, go check us out. Something we're trying to do a little bit new is provide both hands-on and a little bit more forward-looking, kind of futuristic opportunities to dig into technology. So one of the most popular sessions that we're seeing on Interop right now is on neural networking and how that's going to affect IT in the future. It's by a PhD who's a researcher at Microsoft. That's gotten some interest from folks who are curious to think about the real significant technology changes that we're just on the cusp of.
Outstanding. Well, I will remind everyone that on Tuesday, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, we will have the next episode of Interop Radio going out live. I'm going to have Tanaya Hurst. We had hoped to have her last week, but technical difficulties intruded. Tanaya Hurst is a woman who is making it as a manager and business owner, entrepreneur in the makerspace. Fascinating person. I had a good time talking with her at CES. She's going to be joining us on Tuesday. You can find Interop Radio on blogtalkradio.com and on iTunes. Well, Drew, thanks so much for being with us. We'll look forward to having you on again in the future as we get a little bit closer to Interop. I want to keep talking about that great Interop community.
You're welcome, Kurt. It's always a pleasure.
That was Andrew Condrey Murray, who is the man in charge of communities and content and so much more at Interop. Interop Las Vegas, the place that is connecting the IT community, happening from April 27th through May 1st, 2015 at the Mandalay Bay Convention Center in Las Vegas. For more information and to register, please go to www.interop.com. Well, that brings us to the Geek End, that great story every week that's always thought-provoking, always interesting, perhaps slightly offbeat, brought to us by our very own Dave Wagner. Dave, welcome to Information Week Live.
Hi, Kurt. Thanks for having me.
Well, earlier we were talking with Kelly about the user interface, about the cloud, about all kinds of aspects of the Windows 10 announcements this week. You saw those and you focused on something else entirely. What really caught your eye at the Microsoft announcement?
Well, it's a virtual reality helmet called HoloLens. And you're probably wondering why in the world, with Oculus Rift and many of the other competitors, why this is a special virtual reality helmet. But what really separates it, believe it or not, is that the lens, rather than being opaque and having pictures projected on a screen, essentially, before your eyes, HoloLens projects those pictures onto your reality, and it creates essentially what they're calling holograms, although I think there would be some definition quibbles over exactly what a hologram is, but they're calling them three-dimensional images put into reality, and that's a fair enough description, I think, of what a hologram is, and it's really quite amazing to look at.
Now, I have to admit, I spent much of this week at a conference in Orlando, a conference called FETC, that was all about educational technology. And there were a ton of companies there showing augmented reality, which is really what this sounds like, reality with something else projected on top of it. Is that a good representation of what you saw from, do you think that augmented reality might be the blanket term that would cover the HoloLens?
It probably is, except what I'm used to seeing when we think of the term augmented reality is information placed onto something you're looking at. So, for instance, you're walking down the street and you're looking through your Google Glass or something, and it tells you that there is a sale, in the store you're walking by. What this is, I think, is augmented reality 2.0, or augmented reality realized the way we'd always hoped it would be. I think of it as sort of half Google Glass, half Oculus Rift, because it is a computer in itself. Unlike an Oculus Rift, which is essentially a player device. So it is more like augmented reality than virtual reality. But it's an interesting hybrid, or it's an interesting generation step forward that's really hard to describe without seeing it. There's video in my article for those who are interested.
Well, I know that Microsoft also announced in all of the things that they talked about this week, the connection of Xbox to Windows devices. So is this part of the whole gaming area, or do they see, and do you see, broader use for the HoloLens?
It's absolutely something they see a broader use in, but they're no dummies. They see it as part of gaming. One of the things they demonstrated that was really cool was three-dimensional, in front of your eyes, in your own living room, Minecraft. Microsoft recently purchased Minecraft, and they showed a man with a castle he had built on Minecraft on his coffee table, which just blew me away, because one of my complaints about gaming with a helmet has always been that I'm convinced I'm going to trip over my own coffee table. What I loved about this is that it integrated my coffee table into the world, so there was no way I was going to trip on it, and yet I was still immersed entirely in the environment. Yet they see, I think, more of an enterprise viewpoint. They emphasize it as a prototype design aid. One of the things they showed on their stage was a drone being built through a design aid that was the woman that was describing it was able to change colors, change shape, change size, and at the end of it, they were able to 3D print a copy of what she had made. Now, there's a little stagecraft involved there. They didn't print it on stage. They had it pre-printed. Obviously, she didn't design the motor that was associated with it. So there are some limitations to this. But they see it as a way, it uses hand gestures as well as eye movement. So you can look at a prototype of a car, a drone, a helicopter, an airplane, and make changes to its shape using your hands and your eyes in ways that were really impressive.
Well, I know that I have seen at, for example, SAP's Sapphire conference, some gestural control of data analytics demonstrated, as well as some 3D visualization. And it sounds like this is the kind of technology that could well be used in some of this advanced data visualization. After what I saw this week, it strikes me that education is another area where there are some real possibilities. From what you have heard other, you know, reporters and analysts and industry observers say, is HoloLens considered to be one of the big deals coming out of this week's announcement, or is it just a little technology sideshow that people think is probably just going to be a footnote?
Well, I think people are still sorting through what Microsoft said. They gave a lot. I've heard a lot of analysts talking about the pricing model of Windows 10, their model on how they're going to update it, their cloud strategy. There's been plenty of talk about HoloLens, but I think people are still trying to figure out what it is, to be honest. What I think HoloLens has achieved is bridging the gap between an awful lot of things we've been talking about. It's the first one to pull all the pieces together of a lot of things we're really excited about. I think you're right about data visualization. I one of the areas that they're really interested in using it is science. They've already made a deal with NASA. NASA's creating a program called OnSight, which is going to allow scientists to walk the surface of Mars to help understand what the Curiosity rover is seeing and going through. And they're going to be able to walk through the data that Curiosity is bringing out. So I think what we're seeing here is Microsoft pulling together all these pieces you're talking about and putting them together into a whole faster than anybody else was able to do it.
Well, it sounds like lots of interesting technology, and I know that you're going to be one of the people bringing us information on that technology. Can you tell us, though, what you've got on tap and how people can follow you and keep up with all of the things that you were writing about here at Information Week?
Sure. Follow me at GeekNDave on Twitter. Also, you'll find most of my articles in our IT Life section of Information Week. IT Life is our lifestyle section. Find everything in there about your career, about the other things that are interesting to you in and out of your professional life. This Sunday, I have what I think is going to be a really fun package of material coming out. Sunday is the 100th anniversary of the first transcontinental phone call, and the phone is one of the most fundamental pieces of technology in the enterprise. So we are celebrating the phone, the smartphone, the cellular phone, any kind of phone you can think of, by providing you slideshows about the history of our phone from that first transcontinental call to now. We're also going to talk about some other technology that's related to that. And then next Friday on this very show, we will have Bill Coughlin, who is the director of the AT&T Archives. And he's going to come on to do a special interview about the history of the phone and where he sees the future of the phone going. So we're really excited about that package. We hope you guys are going to be excited too. And just for fun, if that doesn't excite you, also today I did a slideshow of the top 10 video games we're hoping are going to excite us coming up this year. So there's plenty to see for me right now.
Outstanding. And, of course, Dave was too modest to note that next Friday for Information Week Live, he will be your host. So we're looking forward to that.
Well, Dave, thanks for being with us. Scare people away.
Oh, no such thing. Dave, thanks so much for being with us this week.
Thank you, Kurt.
That was Dave Wagner, community editor here at Information Week. Please do follow him and all of our guests. There is such a lively and active community of journalists and professionals here at Information Week. We really hope that you will join us and add your voice to the communication. Well, speaking of communication, next week, as I mentioned earlier, Tuesday at 3 p.m. Eastern, we'll have Interop Radio, where once again we'll be talking with Tania Hurst of Lenino.org and Rogue Making, talking about women in technology, especially in the maker movement. And then, of course, next Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern, Information Week Live for another week. Next week, hosted by our own Dave Wagner. Well, for everyone here at Information Week Live, I'm Kurt Franklin saying thanks so much for being with us. We'll see you next time.